This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
Are you aching to travel? To see dream destinations, relatives you miss so much, or business opportunities? How do you justify your next flight, knowing each gallon of jet fuel burn makes the coming climate even harder for all of life? What about buying carbon offsets to cover the flight? We have reached the expert with the answers. In the UK, Professor David Lee is director of the Centre for Aviation, Transport and Environment at Manchester Metropolitan University. David has researched and published atmospheric science for over three decades and on aircraft emissions since the late 1990s. David Lee, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Media and the airline industry tell us vaccinated people are bursting to get back on board. Brits want to go to Spain, Aussies and Germans want to travel all over the world, and Americans take planes everywhere for everything, of course. What is wrong with flying, David?
I guess there's nothing wrong with flying in the sense that it's one of our modern-day activities that we depend on for business and leisure. But in these days of increasing climate awareness and increasing awareness of our actions on climate, I think we have to reappraise what we do, how we do it, and how frequently we do it.
Well, let's take it piece by piece. The prime problem is the climate impact of air travel, as you say, and then we will get to the schemes and calculations to offset that carbon. What is the general consensus of the global contribution of the airline industry to global warming?
That's a relatively easy question to answer because we've done some work on that recently, a group of 20-odd authors. We looked at this issue. The authors are from North America, from Europe, from all around the world, from China. And we calculated that of human impacts on climate, aviation, global aviation, represents about 3.5%.
Well, that doesn't sound by much, but when you add up all the various wedges, it's a big one and it's something we can do something about. Now, I was a little surprised to read this in your published paper in 2021, quote, "Contrail cirrus, consisting of linear contrails and the cirrus cloudiness arising from them, yields the largest positive net warming term followed by CO2 and NOx emissions," end of quote. So changes to the clouds are actually a greater warming than carbon dioxide from burned jet fuel?
Currently, yes. It all depends how you look at things. At the moment, the way we measure this is a metric called radiative forcing of climate. It's the simplest way of looking at things. But it's a backward-looking thing. It's a historical thing and tells you where you are right now as a result of history. So the balance between CO2 as a long-lived greenhouse gas and the short-lived effects, like a change in cloudiness, that balance can change. It's not a fixed amount. But at the moment, we think the largest fraction of the warming is coming from contrail cirrus, which is enhanced cloudiness through linear contrails from aircraft, which can then spread out and form an extensive cloud cover. That has a net warming effect. But at the moment, yes, it's larger than the historical CO2 signal, but that can change. If, for example, if we didn't increase our rate of flying and we just had a kind of flat line of emissions, because CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere, the contrail cirrus effect would stabilize very quickly and it would flatline as an effect. But because CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere, that would become bigger and bigger, even for a constant emission rate. So that little kind of conceptual demonstration of how that ratio is quite sensitive and can change depending on our patterns of travel.
Well, it does surprise me because carbon dioxide can last for thousands, tens of thousands of years in the atmosphere, whereas the clouds, I mean, they come and they go. And if we stop flying, I guess that impact would stop, wouldn't it?
That's correct. Yes, that's absolutely correct. Because carbon dioxide has, it strictly speaking, has multiple lifetimes because it gets taken up by different parts of the Earth atmosphere system. So that is around for a very long time. So a fraction of any CO2 emission, about 20%, is effectively up in the atmosphere, you could say, forever. It's millennia, because that's the kind of fossilization removal time scale. So the problem is, anything to do with CO2, if you have an emission of CO2, the effect is extremely long-lasting. So if hypothetically we stopped flying, that effect from contrail cirrus would go away very, very quickly. But the effect from the CO2 emissions that we've emitted historically, that the effect from them just keeps going and going and going. So that's why it's so problematic on the CO2 side.
David, it might amuse you to know that just talking about contrails has probably triggered in some of our listeners and in others a real interest, because we had to do a whole program with experts to say that no, contrails were not a plot by the powers that be to modify the climate and to cool the earth. They're actually just something that happens when you fly planes around in certain circumstances. Your thoughts?
Yes, that's right. Unfortunately, it was a great game for the conspiracy theorists to talk about contrail cirrus for some time. I remember the first time I came across this in the late 1990s in the US at an academic conference, and we all the scientists around the room looked at each other and laughed, you know, because there was a conspiracy theory going around that somehow the government was spraying us all and trying to either affect our health or affect our fertility or some obscure thing like that. Unfortunately, that conspiracy theory hasn't completely gone away, but of course it's complete rubbish.
Well, how much does it matter that this combustion happens high in the atmosphere, and could we reduce the impacts by flying higher or lower?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting questions that we have looked at as a science community a little bit. In terms of the CO2, because it's so well mixed in the atmosphere, obviously because it lasts for a very long time, hundreds to thousands of years, the vast part of it, it's very well mixed. So it doesn't matter whether you emit CO2 at the surface or at the top of the atmosphere, it has the same effect ultimately. The NOx emissions, you get NOx, that's nitrogen oxides, when you combust fossil fuel in air, and it's a combination of the oxygen and the nitrogen. It's just a high combustion temperature product. That matters where you do it, because the top of the atmosphere for ozone production, which you get from NOx emissions, it triggers a whole set of atmospheric chemistry reactions. And those chemistry reactions can result in both warming and cooling effects, but the net effect is warming from aircraft NOx. But the effect of NOx at the top of the atmosphere, where aircraft cruise for around 10 to 12 kilometers or, you know, 30-odd thousand feet, that tends to have a stronger warming effect overall, because the ozone produced per molecule NOx is higher. The actual physical mechanism, the physics behind how climate change happens on a short-lived climate gas like ozone, varies by the height of the atmosphere. It's almost at its peak forcing warming rate at those cruise altitudes. And the chemistry up there is, perversely, it's relatively clean, but that means we get very fast production rates of ozone. So it's a warming effect that does happen up there. And there's a kind of an analogous thing for contrails and contrail cirrus. Normally, if you introduce clouds into the atmosphere, effectively what you're doing is you're introducing a white surface. So in the scheme of things, you have solar radiation. It finds a white surface and it's reflected back to space. So that's automatically a cooling effect. However, that again depends on the height of the atmosphere. So clouds generated at low levels generally have a slight cooling effect. Whereas clouds at the top of the atmosphere, where aircraft cruise, we get this contrail formation and they spread into linear structures and then, you know, sort of hazy structures of contrail cirrus. Yes, that presents a white surface to space, and it reflects solar radiation back to space during the day, but at night, when there's no sunshine to reflect back to space, they have the effect of trapping infrared radiation, which comes from the ground, because, you know, as solar radiation comes in, it hits the ground and we get infrared radiation. It's at a different wavelength, comes off, and that's what heats the atmosphere. But these clouds at such high levels tend to trap that, particularly at night. So yes, there is a kind of height effect built in with some of these effects to do with aviation.
I don't want to get too deep into the atmospheric chemistry, but can you just note that somewhere in this mix, even methane is affected by airline emissions?
Yes, that's right. It's part of the so-called net NOx effect, because there are a number of effects that happen. So the short-term thing that happens quite quickly on the timescales of, you know, hours, is we get chemical reactions that turn NOx into a molecule called ozone. So that's three oxygen atoms. And at that height in the atmosphere, ozone is kind of not really that good for us. In the stratosphere, of course, it protects us from ultraviolet radiation, very harmful ultraviolet radiation, which otherwise we'd fry without it. That's the stratospheric ozone depletion problem. But lower down in the atmosphere, it acts as a climate warming gas, and it's not really doing that much for us in terms of the UV protection. That all happens in the stratosphere. So you get this formation of ozone, but also there's a molecule produced in all these complex chemical reactions called hydroxyl radical. And what that does is it destroys some of the ambient methane. So aircraft themselves don't emit methane, but some of the gases that aircraft produce in the exhaust, those reactions destroy ambient methane. So if you get a reduction of ambient methane, you can account for that as a cooling effect, if you like. But that cooling effect is smaller than the warming effect at the moment. Although, again, that ratio is not a fixed thing. It depends on what's going on with the chemistry. The chemistry is very, very non-linear, so things don't scale automatically in the way you might think they do. So, you know, twice the emissions doesn't mean twice the effect, and that kind of thing. So yes, methane chemistry in the atmosphere is involved as well.
So, David Lee, the airline industry says they've created more and more efficient engines that burn less and less fuel. And at the same time, statistics of the number of planes up there and miles traveled keep going up and up. Can efficiency win the race?
That's the problem. We basically are consuming, if you like. You know, the growth rate of aviation is faster than the reduction rate that technology is producing. I mean, by no doubt at all, aircraft engines are highly efficient, very, very complicated, and, you know, they represent a kind of pinnacle in technological development. They're really, really fantastic feats of engineering. They're very, very fuel efficient. But the trouble is, the rate at which we can improve the technology is a little bit slow, because if you consider the average lifetime of an aircraft, the main carrier, you know, the main carriers like, say, for example, Air Canada or, you know, Air France, British Airways, whatever, United, they tend to keep their aircraft for around 10 years. But after those 10 years, it's generally sold on to smaller carriers. So on average, an aircraft has a lifetime of about 30 years. So if you imagine how quickly you change your car, you know, that the general public, the fleet turnover, we call it, is quite quick for ground transportation. But for air transportation, the fleet turnover time is quite slow. So that entry into service of new technology, which does indeed improve things, is slow. And we have this inherent consumption statistic of how much we want to fly is outpacing this technological improvement all the time. That's at the core of the problem. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, it's not a huge amount of the global warming signal at the moment. But the trouble is, it's an industry that's very locked into liquid fossil fuels at the moment, and we have a public that wants to fly all the time. So it's a behavioral thing that's hard to change as well. So whilst everything needs to come down quite dramatically if we're going to hit, you know, no more than 1.5 degrees warming, all other industries are trying their best to, you know, bring things down through different technologies and different ways of doing things. Aviation doesn't really have so much choice. There's not much in the bottom drawer, if you like, to look at without changing things quite radically, such as, you know, going to things like hydrogen fuel or doing things like getting the liquid kerosene fuel from different sources and addressing the carbon emissions that way.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. You are listening to the Radio EcoShock show. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, atmospheric scientist Professor David Lee, and we are talking about the real costs of flying. Right, David, let's get on to the offsets. We can buy them. We can find them in various places. There are agents and companies selling us carbon offsets, but we don't know how good they are, and so that's partly why I'm calling you. What is the purported plan behind carbon offsets?
I tend to have a very negative view of carbon offsets because a lot of them that are being sold out there, I think, are being sold on a missold basis, because the language used around them, and you only have to go onto any offsetting site to look for this, and you'll commonly find the language neutralize, so how you might neutralize your emissions. And that just simply isn't true, because the reasonable and dictionary understanding of neutralize is to make null, to make void your action. So you do one thing and you have a consequence, but you do another thing, which means it never happened. And that's the concept being sold behind offsets. The major problem with offsets is the type of offsets that are often sold. For example, the International Civil Aviation Organization offsetting scheme, which is global, and it's a good initiative in the sense that aviation is trying to address its emissions, but I don't think this is the right way, because most of those offsets being sold to you are avoidant. So putting it very crudely, it represents something like a guy stood there with a match burning saying, well, I was going to set fire to this forest, but if you pay me, I won't do it. So the emission that you're offsetting never actually happened, but you pay the guy, the fictional guy, not to blow the match out, and the transaction is complete, and you then go on to emit your fossil fuel. So how is that reducing an emission? It's not. The simple arithmetic behind it doesn't work. You have two intended units of emission. I intend to set fire to this forest, and I won't. You know, that's an avoidance. And you have, I intend to get on a plane and emit a unit of CO2. So it was two intended minus one, which still leaves you one. So that emission from the fossil fuel still happened. So, you know, I think, personally, it's quite a reprehensible business. You know, it's not the way forward, because it's not actually solving problems. It does have other more social advantages, like, you know, habitat protection and things like that. But in the strict sense of does it reduce emissions, no, it doesn't. The atmosphere does not lie. You know, if you put CO2 up there from fossil fuel combustion, you will get an increase in the measurements of CO2.
I know. One of my favorite stories, and I mentioned this to you in email, is of the Canadian promoter Russ George, who managed to convince the Vatican that they would be the first country to be carbon neutral because he would plant a forest in Hungary that would absorb as much carbon as they were putting out, which I severely doubt it ever would, but that was his plan. Well, the forest never got planted, but they made a big promotion about it, and the public thought that it actually happened, but nothing actually happened. Now, one of my listeners was asked to help a company calculate their carbon offsets for airline flights, and he found widely different calculations about how much CO2 equivalence was required, considering the high altitude jet emissions. compared to ground emissions. And there were multipliers of 1.5 all the way up to 3 times for aircraft. What do you make of all that?
That's a very tricky business. It's an aspect that originates in the science, and it originates with all these things and concepts we were talking about earlier about, you know, things having stronger effects than CO2 per unit of fuel burnt, that kind of thing. And it comes from two different directions. Basically, the non-governmental organization lobbyists, though, you know, environmentalists, like to use these kind of what we call metrics, these emission equivalent metrics, to bump up the signal and say, ah, yes, but, you know, it's for every unit of CO2 you emit, it's roughly, you know, say, for example, equivalent to 3 units of CO2, and therefore you ought to pay more attention to it. And I understand and sympathize with that argument. The precise number really depends on how you calculate it. There are different ways of calculating this emission multiplier, and they vary according to your methodology, and there are a number of different methodologies, all robust, all scientifically correct. But one of the critical things is because CO2 is so long-lasting, you have to calculate these emission equivalences over a certain time period. We call it a time horizon. And the answer you get for these emission multipliers depends on the equivalence metric you use. Just to give you examples of that, there's one called the global warming potential. There's another one called the global temperature change potential. And you have to calculate these over different periods. All the numbers are scientifically correct. None of them are wrong. But what they highlight is that there's an element of choice. It's kind of, well, what metric suits you? Does a temperature metric suit your temperature-based target? You know, does a GWP, your global warming potential, are you calculating that to calculate an energy balance, which it's more suited to? And these are highly technical questions, but they get picked up by these kind of multipliers. And then I think they're useful numbers to illustrate the size of the effect, if you like, that currently, you know, aviation may have an effect that's something like 2 to 3 times its implied CO2 emission. Now, I think that is a useful concept. It's accurately describing an effect. But if you start turning that into a monetary value, I have misgivings about that, particularly when it comes to offsetting, of course. So the simple message is there are a number of numbers out there in terms of a multiplier number. Some of them are scientifically wrong. People pick up the wrong method. Some of them are right, but what they don't tell you is that they're highly variable. You know, you could have a number that's 1.1, or you could have a number that's around 3 or 4. It just really depends. And I think by not giving people the range like we do in science, I think it's a bit disingenuous. In terms of calculating things for offsets, well, we've talked about offsets, though, you know, my misgivings about offsets aside, I think in terms of carbon calculators for people's flights, if they want to know how much they're emitting, I don't really like these multipliers. I don't think they're useful for that kind of thing. I think they're a useful communication tool.
For me, one of the big problems is that it's a bad social deal. I mean, I know some forest activists who say, well, yes, we're getting some money from the carbon offset people. We're sending in experts. We might save some endangered species. We might buy some forest land that would otherwise be logged. But we should be doing those things anyway just to save the climate. And we can't do it just as some sort of tax on the airline industry so that, you know, I mean, would we accept the money if it came, say, from prostitution or child labor? Well, no, we wouldn't. And this is another damaging industry, in my opinion. And to take that money and say, well, we're doing some good with a little teeny dribble of a fraction of it, it doesn't wash for me.
I have a sympathy for that point of view. I mean, the way I liken offsets, I mean, I think the public generally they want to do the right thing if they're able to, and if they think, if somebody tells them that you can so-called neutralize your emissions through offsets and their avoidance offsets, you know, it's difficult for the public to understand all these complex topics about carbon cycle and whether things are actually changing or not. Most of the time, they're volunteering to pay this levy when it's not really doing anything. And I think that's not really on. I would liken it to a Lutheran indulgence.
Your work has helped advise the UK government and the EU, I think. And those host some of the world's largest airline industries, plus aircraft manufacturing, of course. How are those governments doing in approaching aircraft and warming, in your opinion?
Here you get into tricky aspects of policy because it depends on something that might feel rather arbitrary in the sense of whether a flight is domestic or international. If a flight is domestic, say within, you know, within Canada or within the UK or within the United States, you know, say for example New York to Denver, that's a domestic flight. Now, the carbon emissions associated with that come under the national policy and their national targets and their so-called nationally determined contributions, which is, you know, how much they say they will reduce emissions by. You know, a country doesn't need to prescribe they're going to do anything to a particular industry. They just need to meet their targets somehow, and that gives them the greatest flexibility. The problem is that of total aviation, the largest proportion of it, about 65%, is actually international travel. So everything in terms of international aviation falls to the UN agency, the International Civil Aviation Organization. So there is this complex situation where things at the international level, which is 65% of global aviation, are dealt with by ICAO, and you know, domestic aviation is dealt in some way under national targets. So governments across the world do have this kind of complex policy situation to navigate through. And again, you know, I've worked in this area on policy advice as a scientist for many years, and I appreciate how difficult it is to navigate this thing. I mean, I think people are doing better. Some countries are starting to declare international emissions within their own national targets. So they're kind of embracing more emissions than they need to and saying that they will do something about them. There's a massively growing awareness about aviation emissions because, as we outlined before, if you like, the problem is not now. The problem is in 10 to 20, 30 years' time when everything is coming down to hopefully net zero through different and faster technology developments which are more radical. Aviation is still kind of stuck with the kind of tube and wing concept running on liquid fuel. You know, it's very, very hard to have a paradigm shift away from that. I think things are going well. There are means, ways and means of fixing things. What it will do is it will make air travel more expensive. I think that's one of the simple conclusions. And you could argue it will make it appropriately expensive.
The pandemic has caused a significant drop in air travel, but now people are talking like they'd really like to get going again. Is there any safe way for the climate to fly? Is it okay, or do we just have to give it up for a while?
There is a very good way forward. It's quite complicated. We basically, if we're stuck, as I said, with the liquid fossil fuels at the moment, and we're stuck with liquid fuels for our aircraft for, you know, the foreseeable future. If we can manufacture those fuels, either from synthetic fuels, you actually manufacture the fuels rather than, you know, refine oil, or you produce them from biofuel and you carefully account for all the carbon life cycle analysis and you produce low carbon footprint fuels, that is the most safe and secure way of doing it. The problem I think that is associated with all that is we know how to do that on synthetic fuels. We know how to make synthetic fuels, but we don't know how to make them at scale and at a reasonable cost. And as I say, it will put the price of flying up. I think the missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle to fix this, and fix it via the fuels is actually the policy in the background that says no more fossil fuels. That's what we need. We need a phase out. We need a declared phase out of fossil fuel usage.
From Manchester Metropolitan University, we've been speaking with Professor David Lee. You can find links to some of David's papers on climate and aviation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for sharing your expertise with us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.